Hello? 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 Are you there? I think we got our little problem resolved, and we're going to start off with some music while I notify people on the forum and on the front page that we're up and running.
Let me see what I can dig up here, the files here at the quiet. Now we're not really at the quiet store, we're the not-so-quiet store. Let's see, what do we have?
We'll start off with a Jewish classic. It's very Jewy, but it's somewhat funny. Now we'll play that second. First we'll play... This is Tully Craft, The Punks Are Writing Love Songs.
Arena seats in a ringtone by the same. Don't know much about these weekend punks, but I've heard they have tons of fame. Street fights and open mics for the baccarat to meet the beat. Anthems written for the discontent, but the eyeliner is key. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The mixing of the bad. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. Punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. Hoods up, colors free from the cul-de-sacs. Bats out, anarchy with a note attached. Blast beats, windows deep in the photographs. Tattoo lyrics from the pretty boys are singing by the back. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. Hat pins and safety pins over the bullets and the curves. You want your record on the radio, you better sweeten up that verse. Abbreviate with the longest names, you can bet that hearts will bleed. Sort of clever and nostalgic ones, we'll sing them poems of breakneck speed. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. Hoods up, poetry from the cul-de-sacs. Bats out, anarchy with a note attached. Glass beads, window seats in the photographs. Tattoo lyrics from the teddy boys are singing back to the back. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the back. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad.
Let's go up and down Avenue.
Okay, that was Punks Are Writing a Love Song by Tully Craft, and then we had Sinking Ships by the Archibald. Now, we're going to play a couple more while I recover my equanimity, which was lost during our technical problems, which drive me endlessly crazy. Me not being a technical guy, and in fact, hating the very technology that allows me to bring you the important news we're going to discuss a little bit later today. So right now, we're going to do one of my favorite kike-ass songs, which is the Minivan Song by Jim Crewson and Kiki. And I don't know if you like it, but I find it kind of amusing. We're playing with sound levels a little bit here to try to get it just right. And so, the Minivan Song.
People's old junk, and always keeping one step ahead of the man. And when the lights go down on the Pensacola flea market parking lots, we're gonna check into a sleazy motel, hit the Applebee's and raise some hell. We're just a teen traveling hippie and a bow-legged stripper in a minivan. We're selling people's old junk and always keeping one step ahead of the man. Now when the lights go down on the Pensacola flea market parking lot, we're gonna check into a sleazy motel, hit the Applebee's and raise some hell. And there's a teen-timing hippie and a bow-legged stripper and a minivan.
Hey, mister, let me offer you a 20 and a quarter for that beat-up old guitar. Well, I'll bet you half a dollar that the FBI knows where we are. But I didn't rape nobody, why can't you all just leave a feller alone? Honey, hand me that tie stick, I'm feeling like I wanna get stoned.
We're just a teen-timing hippie and a bow-legged stripper and a minivan. We're selling people's old junk and always keeping one step ahead of the man. And when the lights go down on the Pensacola flea market parking lot, we're gonna check into a sleazy motel, hit the Applebee's and raise some hell. We're just a two-timing hippie and a bow-legged stripper and a minivan.
When we get to Tijuana, gonna be who we wanna be and set up camp.
Gonna push out some babies, never let another motherfucker call me tramp again.
But for right now, darling, just you keep on shaking it on top of that sticky bar. And if it makes no difference to you, honey, I'll go wait in the car.
We're just a teen-timing hippie and a bow-legged stripper and a minivan.
was selling people's old junk and always keeping one step ahead of the man. And when the lights go down on the Pensacola gleam like a parking lot, we're gonna check into a sleazy motel, hit the Applebee's and raise some hell. We got that two-diamond hippie and a bow-legged stripper and a minivan. We're just a two-timing hippie and a bow-legged bleached blonde pockmarked saggy titty bow-legged stripper in a minivan.
Alright, that was the Minivan song by Jim Crewson and Kiki. Before that, starting at about 2:35 Central Standard Time, probably stepped on a worm, we had The Punks Are Writing Love Songs by Tullycraft. Then we had Sinking Ships by the Archibalds. And now we're going to do our official kickoff song. After that, I'm going to talk a little politics for 10-15 minutes to get the feel down, because there's some interesting stuff we have to discuss today, including pro-fag law signed by Schwartz's nigga in California. What could you start? We're going to talk about that driving the Christians out of the public schools there. We're going to talk about Australia. We're going to talk a little bit about the corruption of the ATF, as highlighted by their warm-up for 911, the Oklahoma City bombing. I'll have quite a bit to say about that, even though we're not going to go... we're going to dig a little into The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, The Unreported Stories by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, one of the better mainstream reporters in the world today. But let's kick it off with our starting song. It's a little ditty by a young man named Bill Bailey, and it's called Mr. Brownstone.
We'll be right back.
That was Mr. Brownstone, and you know what? I'm tempted to play more music, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm going to do what I said, and we're going to lurch into a little bit of political analysis here. All right? Can you stand that? And we're going to have a lot more music lined up. I got it queued up and waiting. I'm taking everything I have to resist playing it right now. We're going to hear some Prince. We're going to hear some Matthew Sweet. We're going to hear some Johnny Rebel. You might hear a little bit of Coontown. I don't think anybody can argue with Coontown. And we're going to hear Fatboy Slim? No, we're not going to hear Fatboy Slim. Too much has already been heard from Fatboy Slim. We're not going to add to that massive pile of nastiness. What else are we going to listen to? Fountains of Wayne? I think not. Fish? Hell no. Osric Tentacles? No, we're not going to listen to that either. Now, let's see. We could listen to a little Eminem. Where is it? The Kids. Yeah, we'll listen to that. I know some people don't like that. But I do. We'll hear that a little bit later coming up. And all that remains is a little bit of the Cat. In honor of a close friend of mine whose cat contracted lung cancer and died after racking up $1,500 in bills from the vet, we'll play one of my favorite songs by the Cat. Where is it here? There it is. We'll play that a little bit later, though. Because right now, we're going to talk about fags. We're going to talk about deviants. We're going to talk about homos. We're going to talk about rump rangers. We're going to talk about gluticians. Eminent and unrecognized, but always destructive. Always destructive. Now, let me give you a little insight in the true source of originality, which is far more often a permutation. Let's call it a twist. It's a twist on something original. Menken, and I believe. Now, maybe I may be wrong about this. He certainly used the word a lot, but back in his day, they had something called prohibition. That was when the slimy creeps who today are at work on such things as banning public smoking were all hot under the collar about alcohol, and they got it banned for about 10, 15 years. Of course, it was still accessible by lots of people, but they did have enough Bible belters. These are the mouth-breathing morons who eat dirt. And when their mouths aren't full of dirt, they're yawping for a moronic, warmongering lunatic like John McCain. Well, they got alcohol banned for 10 or 15 years, and during that time, Mencken would call those who supplied alcohol booticians. So I twisted the word, applied it to the likes of homosexuals like Dennis Justin Raimondo, and called them gluticians. The glutes being those massive lumps below your spine on either side of your legs. I think some of you know what I'm talking about. So, there are many names for faggots. We don't really need to go into all of those today. What we need to do is observe that they're a minority. The gross estimates of the social scientist liars are that they're 10% of the population. That's not true. there may be 1 or 2% in any ordinary society. And they're a tiny, disliked group that is promoted by the people behind TV, many of whom are fags themselves, and the others of whom are Jews. TV is essentially a Jew-faggot production. They're promoted because they break down white families and they lead to a consumerist, materialist, live-for-the-day, hedonist mentality. That's why faggotry is promoted for white youth, parallel to the way bestiality, race-mixing, miscegenation is promoted for white female youth. But, you see, I'm already starting to digress. That's one of the characteristic features of this radio show. I'm like a dog that sees stuff and runs off after it. But you know what? It always comes back to the same end. Because everything that I'm going to say that you're going to hear on Radio Astina is going to underline a handful of themes that are necessary for whites to understand so that they have the groundwork to retake their nation from the people who actually control it today. And we're going to talk about a number of fronts. We're not just going to talk about fags and public school education and the homeschooling movement. We're going to talk about Australia. Their prime minister just issued an apology to the so-called First Nation. I'm sorry, that's the Canadian term for it. And one of the things we always do in the show is tie this all together. You'll see the connection between the Indians in America, blacks, civil rights movement in America, and what the Jews have tried to do in Australia with regard to the Aborigines, as they're called there, the First Nation in Canada, as they're called there. Every one of these places, Jews are forcing whites to apologize to the so-called Aboriginals and to fund them indefinitely. Tribal welfare, like we subsidize the niggers, they subsidize the Indians up in Canada, they subsidize the Aboriginals down in Australia. We'll talk about that a little later. And then we'll get into the ATF part. But right now, I want to say we began this this show. Radio Astina began last year in 2007, and it culminated in a two-part daily show on, I think it was, September 18th. Did 4 hours, and then I did another two and a half hours late night, which I really shouldn't have done, but I did. And after that, I was going on a 3-day vacation, and during that, I got sick. I came down with a condition. It's called Crohn's, C-R-O-H-N-S. And from that point until about a month ago, I was basically being slapped by waves of illness and just, what do I do? What do I do? Now I'm recovered to the point where I can do this show again, so I'm going to try to do it once or twice a week, despite various problems. But anyway, this condition is extremely, it's just irritating. It's irritating. It's funny, I found out that one person who has it is Shannon Doherty, and I can guarantee that this condition accounts for the cunt-like look of her aspect. That's her face, for those of you who are less educated, her mien, her facade. Because it's exhausting, draining, and just all-around goddamn annoying condition. And I curse the God that sent it to me. Anyhow, that's beside the point. But we're resuming the show. We're going to do it regularly. Also, Dietrich's resuming. He's picking up. Bud's going to put down his show on Friday night. Dietrich's going to resume his Radio Free Whitelandia on Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. So watch for that tomorrow. And with that, with no further ado, then 10 or 15 minutes of complete bullshit, let's turn to our first story. I can locate my stuff here. Where is it now? Okay. Now, what we're going to talk about. Now, what I tell our guys on the radio is what I'm going to demonstrate here today. And that's to set the context, okay? The news stories are the pegs for the themes. The themes are what need to be got across, and there's just a few simple ones to understand who politically controls the country. If you think the country's going in the right direction, this show will not be interesting to you. You'll go, okay, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with celebrating niggers? And what's wrong with celebrating homosexuals? What's wrong with Jews? They're highly educated people and very ethical. But for those of you who think there is something wrong with the U.S., the value of this show is giving you the why. The conservatives that we are competing with will never give you the why. They will stick to berating some of the milder symptoms, but they will never explain to you the underlying cause of those symptoms, the disease. Right? We give you the disease, and in one short word, the cause of everything major, the cause of every major dysfunction in America traces to Jews. That's all you need to understand. The Jew is your enemy. And I'm going to prove that this show, not by an American example, but by an analogy from Australia. And you will see the parallel. You will see that wherever there are lands that are majority whites, and the Jews are admitted as free and equal citizens, they work as a group to undermine the majority that let them in, to undermine its free speech, to take away its guns, and to force it into legal second-class status, and to force it to subsidize the non-whites, whatever type they are, that exist in that country. In America, it's the descendants of slaves. In Australia, it's the Aboriginal people. In Canada, it's the so-called First Nations, who aren't actually First Nation. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. For those of you who aren't aware that white men were the first to inhabit the Americas, that's a scientific fact. Scientific fact. But let's start with our story here. Our story is about schooling. It's about public schooling. And let's set the context here. Do you know how many people are in public school? No, let's set a deeper context. Why do we call it public schooling? And why do we call homeschooling homeschooling? I suggest we call them what they are. One is slave schooling, in which people are forcibly taken from their homes and stuck in institutions where they are taught to hold the right attitudes. Public schooling is, as they call it, is deliberately anti-intellectual. That is, it doesn't teach the child how to think so that he learns how the proper use and operation of his mind. It teaches him, you must think this. So it's a misuse of the head and the rational facility that so-called public schools are inculcating in your children. That's why the homeschooling movement, which ought to be called free schooling, has developed. Now let me tell you, there are about 48 million slave schoolers in the U.S., people who attend public school, where there's a pool of about that many who are of the public school age. And of that pool, about 2 million, if you believe the home, if you believe the free schooling advocates, 2 million are in home schools. And about 48 or 46 million are in public schools. So we're talking 3 for 4% of the population that's that age is actually being schooled at home rather in so-called public schools. That's the context here. What we've said is that public schools are brainwashing youth to hold attitudes that are congenial to those who actually exercise the political power in our country. And much as it is with TV stations, those who exercise power in America are first Jews, but in close alliance with them are the faggots. Now, what they've succeeded in doing in California is putting through a couple of laws that have been signed by Arnold Schwarzenegger that essentially force textbooks to contain the fags' narrative of their own history. So, nothing that shows any bias or any discriminatory attitude towards homosexuals will be allowed to appear in a California textbook, but what will appear is a bogus positive narrative of how they've struggled and overcome oppression by the man. All they wanted to do was interior decorate and get their butts on, and the man suppressed them by calling them sexual deviants. Well, now they're liberated. What are they liberated to do? What do liberated fags do? They spread AIDS. They demand money from straights. They essentially demand that normal people subsidize their deviant lifestyle. They go out and acquire diseases that are nothing more than the result of the suppression of their immune system brought on by their extraordinary drug taking and ridiculously promiscuous behavior. They want to force the rest of us to subsidize cures for their condition. But in fact, there's a very good argument that AIDS is not even caused by a virus. The HIV is a retrovirus. They aren't known to cause diseases like that. They aren't known to, and viruses in general don't cause diseases that show up 20 years after the fact. So what it is, as Peter Duisberg at Berkeley and others argue, is it's simply AIDS is simply a politically Semitically correct name for a collection of symptoms that are a result of immune system suppressed by, as I said, drug use and, you know, partying. Too much fucking. Too much drug use. So, the homosexuals, having been enabled by the Jews because they treat them as a minority group that they can, that the rest of us are forced to respect, have gained enough power to push through the legislature laws that are going to rewrite California's books. In response, the conservative Christians who have always dominated the revived homeschooling or free schooling movement in the early 80s and made it legal where it was illegal before, for many, many years it was illegal. The history in a nutshell of public education in America is that there wasn't any until Horace Mann up in the Northeast started advocating, and they started funding schools for the poor in the Northeast, and gradually that spread. And what you find anywhere that public schooling spreads, it's always teaching doctrines that are congenial to the state and the people who are operating the state, to get beyond the libertarian point. They always stick to the safely abstract state. You got to go beyond that to the actual actors and their actual agenda. And the actors with an agenda, as we see in the Middle East, are Jews. In the Middle East, what do they want for whites? They want whites to go over there and fight their wars for Israel, make the Middle East safe for Israel. What do they want on the domestic front? Well, they want to favor non-whites over whites. Well, how does that ramify in the public school? Well, you have the educational agenda set out of Washington and the Department of Education. Conservatives used to talk about getting rid of that department. Well, they don't. They didn't do it under Reagan. They're sure as heck not going to do it now under Bush or any future president. So they write the agenda. Textbooks are compiled, and the writers of these textbooks, and California is one of the largest states in the nation. It's, think of it as about 10% of our nation and population, and 10% of our nation and population, it's ahead of the curve on the multiculturalism and the rest of the radical agenda because it's filled with minorities. It's about 50-50. I mean, whites are actually a minority there because whites have been leaving because of the huge Mexican illegal influx and also the influx from Asia. So it's ahead of the curve in terms of the Jewish communist radicalization, and that reflects in the laws and the textbook. California is also essentially bankrupt right now because of the same thing. When you bring in these low IQ coloreds, they don't understand responsibility. They're not capable of controlling their own lives. They have to dip out of the government till, and that means they have to take money from whites in order to survive. That's why the whites leave. They don't get anything out of government except tax bills. And there's less space for everybody. There are less resources to go around. It becomes miserable. And part of this is, at the same time, the minorities nowhere can tolerate any kind of criticism of themselves. And where they have the power, they like to ban it. As we know from Canada, it's illegal for Christians to criticize homosexuals. And it's illegal for them to criticize Jews. And it's illegal for them to criticize minorities in any way, to expose minorities to any kind of hate or hostility or criticism, and that includes citing crime facts. And what we've done at VNNforum.com is we put together a free speech archive, and there you can find the laws of the various nations as they relate to free speech, and you can also find individual victims of these Jew-led campaigns of persecution against men who say precisely what I'm saying here today. And they are in jail in Germany, in France, in England, and in Canada in large numbers. These are good men. They're honest. They simply refuse to go along with the tide of the times, and they stick to speaking facts. And for their trouble, they are fined, they're beaten up, and they're thrown in jail. Well, what they've succeeded in doing in Canada is what they're trying to do in California and in the U.S. That's get rid of the First Amendment. But along the way, besides simply redefining free speech like you're hearing today as hate speech and trying to outlaw it in that area and trying to outlaw historical opinions, as both of which they've done in Canada and in Europe, they've outlawed certain historical opinions, got men thrown in jail over them, and they've redefined hate speech as something illegal. And that certainly, believe me, that is not opinions or epithets. That is the simple citing of facts is declared illegal in those places. They're trying to do the same thing here. Now, still going to the context, what you have is a resuscitated homeschooling movement in the U.S. Now, I left off the history. Public schooling started 1840s, 1850s in Massachusetts. You know, so we had the colonies, then we formed the nation, then the best educated, the most genius-filled generation of Americans was entirely schooled at home. And they might have gone to Harvard or one of the few colleges after they'd been tutored at home. And I'm talking about Jefferson, Washington, Adams, Monroe, John Jay, and the rest of these people. They were all tutored at home. There were no public schools at that time. And then they would go on to university, the better ones of them. So into this, you had the typical social reformers. As Protestantism, as Puritanism decayed, they started preaching the need for public schools. They started setting them up, and by, I think later in the 1800s, it became pretty common across the board to see public schools in every town. And what you had was Americans going over to Germany. Germany was quite popular at this time before 1900 because it had PhD programs, and you had American educators would go over there and get PhDs. And the Prussians set up a system that even a lot of the neocon shills will admit that today's system is based on the Prussian system. Of course, they feel free to insult and use as a negative the Prussian because you don't get in trouble for criticizing Prussians. But it is a fact that the Prussians had set up public schools that became the model for many American public schools. That is, feet forward, looking forward, desks and files, a bell every 50 minutes, and you're racing around. Basically, it's semi-military, and you're not encouraged to think. You're encouraged to know just what the state wants you to know. Well, this became the model for American public schools rather than the free schooling and the private tutoring that had obtained earlier. And, of course, public schools soon became mandatory. You understand the difference? People don't want to learn, but they're forced to go to school. School doesn't mean you're going to learn anything. It just means you're forced to go to some building and listen to some nitwit. It doesn't mean that there's actual learning going on, whereas privately, if it's not working or you're not interested, you simply don't do it. Most people don't want to be educated, and only 10% are capable of true college material, and most people only want to be educated to a functional extent. If they need to do something for a job or for their life, then they will learn it, and they will learn it the most efficient way possible. Well, that has nothing to do with public school. Well, into this new environment around 1900, we started to have the rise of these large corporations, and they found it useful to have the public schools create sort of anti-intellectual cogs to fit into their system. So they were happy with public schools, as was the state, which could indoctrinate kids in its own nationalist version of American history. Be it false or true, it served the needs of the state, just as it did in Prussia. Okay, so what happened also around that time, the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 20th century, is you had a massive influx of Jews. And Jews joined and began to influence America's academic setup in a number of ways. First, they began to join the Ivy League. And even when they were bitching that they were underrepresented and they were being held out and socially discriminated against, they were still 10% of those institutions at that time. Now they're more like a third of the Ivy League and 50% of the law school professors. So they took over that aspect. They went to Columbia Teachers College, they took that over, they instilled new methods of educating teachers. So these nitwits who become education majors are all trained in Jewish doctrines, and 99 out of 100 of them don't realize it. They think they're getting the latest and the greatest instruction in how to teach kids, but in fact they're being indoctrinated. The Jews also set up bogus schools of pseudoscience, such as psychiatry and such as anthropology, and they destroyed real anthropology, physical anthropology, that is fact, bone, and artifact-based archaeology and anthropology, and they substituted for that the lie that race does not exist. And they had, that was created by Franz Boas, a Jew immigrant from Germany to America. He created the School of Anthropology, and his minions, his disciples, created similar schools all around the country at the top universities. And that's just an example of how they spread bogus doctrines that are anti-white. Because, white culture is no better than, say, Aboriginal culture in Australia, as we'll talk about later. That's how they propagate these waves of lies through the country. So all this became rigidified and very common in the U.S. from 1850 to, say, 1950. And everybody's forced to go to public school. They're forced to learn the same national narrative. They're forced to learn the lies that race does not exist or race doesn't matter and that whites are evil. They came here and killed off all the red men. Lincoln didn't destroy the country by ending it as a Federalist, working together of private independent states. Rather, he saved the Union. He killed 600,000 Americans. Ignore the fact that he was totally racist. Ignore the fact that he imprisoned the Maryland Assembly when it went against him, that he shut down hundreds of newspapers and imprisoned all kinds of editors. Ignore all that. He saved the Union. What he actually did, and the reason that he celebrated, is that he centralized political power in the U.S. Right, this huge continent, you don't need one political power running it. Oh, you might need a common defense, but even then, no one's going to invade us because they have to cross an ocean to do it. The Canadians aren't going to invade us. They don't have enough forces. Mexico is the only one that could cause trouble, and even that would be easy to shut down. The Mexicans are being let in because, again, it serves the agenda of the powers that be. And you'll hear people go so far as to say, well, yeah, it serves the Republicans, providing them with cheap labor. True. It serves the Democrats by providing them with voters. True. But the part that goes unsaid is the third and most important reason. Jews want countries that are white, stable, and homogenous to be undermined because Jews feel safer in places that look like New York City, which is a grab bag of racism people where they're about a third of the population. What they don't want is a population that is 99% white and Christian, where they are a tiny 1% minority. They always work to undermine that, not just in America, but in Australia also, and in Europe too. They only start bitching when some of the muds they let in that are disrupting white lives begin to disrupt their own lives, typically because those muds are Muslims, and they know what Jews are about, and they're not easily undermined themselves because they dress, eat, think, and behave differently than Jews do, and they stick together, and they're not afraid to lose their lives in fighting Jews. Those are the type the Jews have problems with. Nice, fair, tolerant, easygoing white people like us, they love that. We're easy to eat. We don't stick together. If they attack us, we just go down. Like right now, Stormfront's being attacked. Stormfront's been up since 1995. How are the Jews able to attack it with impunity? You know, why doesn't the FBI come in and bust them for interfering with our civil rights to exercise our First Amendment? You know, if you leave a leaflet in a nigger's home or in his mailbox or something, they come in and claim that you're trying to disrupt the nigger's civil rights. But the Jews have a history of going after whites who try to tell other whites what's actually going on in this country and shutting them down. If they get any advertisers, they go to the advertiser and they threaten boycott and they threaten other illegal actions. This is what's actually going on in America. Until whites band together and physically destroy the Jews, nothing will change. That's the bottom line here. That's the bottom line of every show and every word that appears on VNN. Whites must band together and destroy the Jews who are destroying us. That's what the conservative will never tell you. Have I gotten to the story? No, I haven't. But you see how it all fits together. Now, to go back again to the story of public schooling in the U.S., the writers you want to read if you want to get a background on this, John Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, award-winning school teacher. He tells you all about, he'll focus on the corporate aspect I mentioned, where the giant corporations in the state have a mutual interest in setting up a system that produces cogs who have their head filled with a, quote, right attitudes, unquote, about work, about being bossed around rather than free men, and about the history of the country, so that they have the political ideas and the economic and the lifestyle ideas that the government and the large corporations want them to have. He won't tell you the Jewish aspect, but he will give you lots of good background on the Prussian basis of the system, the idea of a system. They built it in Prussia first. That's why they call it Prussian. It's not that it's inherently German or Prussian that matters. It's the schools are set up to serve the state. They repeat only the state's agenda. Whatever the state's agenda is, that's what the kids are taught in so-called public schools. And that's what their parents are taxed to have them taught. So there's kind of a double burden that homeschoolers face. And what happened was, private tutoring gave way to public schooling by the mid-decades of the 1800s, and it grew as the nation grew and the technology grew and everything else grew. Mass corporations arose. Before the 20th century, you didn't really have, you know, giant international conglomerates. You had private local business, but the rise of transportation, the growth of technology, well, all these things started to bring about national brands, both commercially and, if you think about it, also politically. You know, before you have the transportation, the rest of it, it's hard to have a true nation when, you know, you don't... How is someone in California in Gold Rush times, how are they connected to someone in, say, Connecticut? I mean, by a letter every 6 weeks or something? Or by a float trip down to the, you know, the Panama Canal, which wasn't even built, so they have to go all the way around, you know, all the way around the tip of South America. I mean, there's no national connection there, but once you have the infrastructure, both electronic and physical, interstate highway grid, then you start to have a nation. You can have national brands, people eating the same thing instead of going to their local store and eating their local pigs and their local fizzy concoctures like Coca-Cola used to be. So now, out of this matrix, this goes along to the 50s or 60s, you start to see some hippies like, you know, I'm not really interested in what they're teaching. Hippies and Christians started to drop out of the system, or they started to realize the system is teaching our kids stuff we don't want them taught. And at this time, homeschooling was literally illegal. And what happened in the late 60s and the 70s up to the early 80s was they fought all these, and they got the laws reversed to where homeschooling became legal again pretty much in every state by about 1983. Another guy who writes about this is, got his book here beside me. It's, what is it? Blumenfeld, Samuel Blumenfeld. Now, he may be a Jew. He's a Christian, but he may have been a Jew. He's originally from New York, but he has written a number of books that go into the same area as John Gatto and what I'm talking about here today. I recommend looking up his stuff and understanding what's going on with homeschooling. He's out of Idaho, and he's a Christian. But not everyone named Blumenfeld is a Jew necessarily, but Samuel Blumenfeld, hailing from New York City, probably he is. But his stuff is decent on this. Anyhow, so the Christians and the hippies, but mainly the Christians, develop the legal freedom to do this. And the numbers have grown fairly rapidly, and more rapidly more recently, to the extent, as I said, there are about 2 million people, according to the Homeschooling Legal Defense Association. It's one of the main drivers of this. And it's led by an evangelical Christian with about 10 kids named, I think, Michael Ferris. He's a guy in Virginia. 2 million of them and growing numbers are homeschooling. And, of course, you all know about homeschoolers win spelling bees, and they do better on the tests. And they also spend much less time than kids who are forcibly imprisoned in public schools. And they also spend much less money. I don't know if you realize, but public schools spend about $10,000 a student in many places, whereas homeschoolers on average spend about $500 to $600 a year. So for a tenth of the price, they're getting at least 2, 4, 8, 10 times the result. You know, public schooling is just another government institution, and the government doesn't do anything well. Nothing well. If you think I'm wrong, think about what the government does in comparison to what private corporations do. What does the government do well? Nothing. So now, as you have growing numbers since the early 80s of people who are opting out of the system that's increasingly politically correct or Semitically correct, increasingly anti-white, and increasingly is using very crappy agitprop-filled textbooks. Okay, we're back on. I guess we lost there. We lost the Okay. I'm going to recapitulate. I think we lost our connection about 3, 4, 5 minutes ago. What I'm going to talk about is a brief history of public schooling in the U.S., and then we're going to get into this. The most brilliant generation ever produced in the North American continent was produced entirely without public schooling. And it was created by private tutoring, and people learned what their parents thought they ought to learn and what they had an interest and an aptitude for learning. But public schooling became common in the 1850s, the middle decades of the 19th century, and it spread and grew for the next 100 years. And at that point, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, up to the early 80s, you had people begin to get really fed up with the garbage that they were being taught, or simply thinking that they could teach their kids better themselves. And so what they did, the hippies and the conservative Christians began to withdraw from the system. They called it homeschooling or unschooling in certain cases, and teach their own. And they were activist enough to begin to press legislatures to allow homeschooling. Homeschooling was literally illegal in most states in the 60s and the 70s. And they had the Christians primarily were the ones, the driving power that got those laws reversed, so that by 1983, in most states, homeschooling or free schooling, as I like to call it, became legal again. So we have them to thank for that. Now, today there are about 2 million homeschoolers, according to the Homeschooling Legal Defense Association. The NEA claims there are only about 1 million, but the point is both sides might have incentives to exaggerate or to underplay how many there are, but there are certainly more than a million and possibly more than 2 million who are homeschooling. Certainly the numbers are growing as people realize that schools aren't functional in any sense. All they do is spread agitprop. Most of what they say isn't true. The little they instruct can be learned much more easily and quickly outside of schools. And so we've seen a rise in homeschooling, not just in the U.S., but in other nations around the globe. And most of those have very strict laws. In Germany, for example, it's more or less completely illegal. And the state will often fixate on those who are trying to educate their kids at home and literally haul them off, steal them from their parents. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what we have now is one of the signs of this growing revolution. What I was saying when I think we were cut off is that homeschooling is really a very strong revolutionary movement, because when you reject, when you understand that public schools are set up to repeat, they're set up to create, to spread attitudes and create the type of people who will be congenial to the state. The state is not going to spread any facts or any attitudes that are hostile to its own powers. The people who operate the state are the Jews. We don't just stop where the libertarians do in talking about the state. We go beyond and say, who are the actual actors who constitute the state? Well, they're Jews. Jewish money owns America. Jewish media tell America what it thinks it knows. And Jewish attitudes are very definitely inculcated through these so-called, you know, historical textbooks that are used by your kid. So when you withdraw from the system, it's a very real and very revolutionary rejection of the system. And even though the reverberations of that fact might not become revolutionary for years, it has to very much concern the huge political power that is the NEA and that is the organized Jewry when people start opting out of the system, even at their own cost. And you got to understand, homeschoolers spend on average about $500, $600 a year, whereas public schools spend $10,000 per student, yet they get worse results than homeschoolers. What does that tell you? It tells you that public schooling, like every other public institution, like every other government office, is incompetent at what it does, if you accept what it claims it's trying to do at face value. But in fact, you shouldn't do that. It's not trying to educate your kid. It's trying to indoctrinate him, inculcate state-acceptable lies in him, and brainwash him. All it cares is that he has the right attitudes on the central political questions of the day, and those attitudes will support the state. Those attitudes will say that, you know, the people at Waco were not simply free Americans trying to live their lives. They were dangerous religious extremists who decided to commit suicide. That's ultimately the reductio ad absurdum, ad deathum, of public schooling. It's going to teach you whatever the government does, it's right. All political power should be centralized. And it will teach you all the rest of the doctrines that you see on TV and you hear everywhere else. So Christians were the first ones to withdraw from this, and they have opened the door legally for whites. Whites may dislike different aspects or have a different emphasis in their reasons for withdrawing from the state. Most of the Christians will withdraw because they don't like the sexual material taught in schools, and they don't like the anti-God attitudes, the attitudes toward religious on the part of the secular humanists, as they will call the enemy. We withdraw because we don't like the racial stuff being taught, but there's a huge overlap between their concerns and our concerns, because both of us want to live as normal white people in a normal white nation. And rest assured, the vast majority of homeschoolers are white. although they will definitely renounce any kind of a racial aspect. But clearly, that is a large portion of what's driving it. It may be concealed by such things as bullying or the poor intellectual quality of the work in the public schools, but ultimately, these are racial concerns, as we know. Now, so homeschooling becomes essentially legal in all states in about the early 80s. Within 20 years, we have a leader of millions of Christians, or at least hundreds of thousands. He's a name familiar from Focus on the Family. His name's James Dobson. He's a PhD. He stated on his radio show, in the state of California, this is in 2002, if I had a child there, I wouldn't put the youngster in a public school. I think it's time to get our kids out, and I'm going to get hit for saying that. In a statement to supporters, Marshall Fritz, president of the Alliance for Separation of School and State, said, for years, Dr. Dobson has supported three options for Christians: public schools, Christian schools, and homeschooling. With today's courageous and insightful statement, Dr. Dobson joins the millions of Americans who have already discovered that the public schools have become government indoctrination centers, which are no place to train new generations of freedom-loving Americans. And this statement also says that Dr. Dobson's statement may mark a key turning point in the critical education discussion. His broadcast is heard by 200 million people daily in over 100 countries. So this is a guy with some pull. And when he is overtly rejecting the state, that is a significant thing. That was in 2002. Now let's jump forward to 2008. You've got enough of the history, and if you didn't get it this time, you'll get it another time. I'll keep talking about it. And what we want to discuss now is this law in California that has been signed. I guess there's two of the lines, and they've been signed by a Schwarzenegger, who's the governor of California, which is a bankrupt state. And I'm gonna have to do a little reading here. Now, I've kind of given you the background of public schooling. I've given you the origin and the theory of it. Before 1850, it didn't really exist. Well, it did exist, but it was not in America. It was developed in Prussia first. And the Prussian model of a way to take children away from their parents and raise them up to be good state cogs, whether serving the army, as in Prussia, the state as in Prussia, the state bureaucracy as in Prussia, or the giant industrial conglomerates as in the U.S., that was the purpose of public schooling. Homeschooling and free schooling is what produces geniuses and free men who will go their different ways, and they won't be so easily dominated and lied to as, say, Fox viewers. So public schools will produce little suckers who want to watch Fox. Free schooling will produce men who think any number of different ways. Anyway, so 2002, James Dobson says, get your kids out of California schools. Now we jump forward to 2008. And we're going to talk about, there's a new campaign called Rescue Your Child that is being driven by the California Christian conservative religious people to get Christians out of the California public school. Now, I said there are about 48 million kids in public schools across the nation. Well, about 6 million of them are in California, and what they're hoping to do, the Christians, is get 10% of those out, drive 600,000 kids out. Now think, that will mean such a huge loss of revenue for the state that it's very disturbing if they can actually do that. Here's what they say. This is from a WorldNet Daily article. If you care about your children, homeschool, find a Christian school, participate in a homeschool co-op, pay the tuition, drive an older car, whatever is necessary to keep them out of California's public school system. That's the message from a new campaign assembled under the Rescue Your Child slogan. And it's all because the California legislature and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger worked together to establish Senate Bill 777 and Assembly Bill 394 as law. Plans that institutionalize the promotion of homosexuality, bisexuality, transgenderism, and other alternative lifestyle choices. This is a quote now from Randy Thomason, chief of the Campaign for Children and Families and a leader in the movement to withdraw what supporters pray will be up to 600,000 children. He says, Randy Thomason, who's heading this up, says, first, California law allowed public schools to voluntarily promote homosexuality. Then the law required public schools to accept homosexual, bisexual, etc. teachers as role models for impressionable children. Now the law has been changed to effectively require the positive portrayal of homosexuality, etc., 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 to 6 million children in California government-controlled schools. So step by step by step by step, the homos and the Jews promote their agenda at the expense of your child's soul, character, and mind. And that is why you have to get your kids out of these damn government schools. Transgenderism being promoted to kindergartners, you know, sex education for 6-year-old kids, and it's not sex education, it's attitudinal adjustment in matters related to the groin. Fags are normal. People can have two fathers or two mothers. That's normal. That's good. And nothing contrary to that can be caught in a government school. Do you not think it's time for revolution when that's what's going on? A little bit more here and then we'll take a music break. And we'll come back for a second hour on Australia. I think we've been going about an hour now. But why are parents concerned? What will the implementation look like? Thomason asks. Imagine a teacher saying, class, for our contemporary social studies non-discrimination bias component, we have a special speaker today. He will share his amazing story of growing up as a male, trapped in a woman's body. This is the type of gender-bending education which students may have to endure unless their parents rescue them from the increasingly negative public school environment. Now, these two laws, SB 777 and AB 394, became law on January 1st. But they're saying it'll take some time to work through the system, so get your kids out in the meanwhile. And this is something also we have at VNN, in VNNforum.com. If you go down to the learning section, under there we have sticky threads with homeschooling resources. So you can pick up a lot from the Christian conservatives. Maybe you don't want your kid taught that religious stuff, but that's a good place to start. Parents Anthony and Yvette Witcher of Los Alamitos and Marty Goble of Laguna Hills said they are looking to turnkey curriculum programs such as Alpha Omega Publications, Class, and Bob Jones University Press. So there's this whole alternative media of the type that Pierce described that has grown up. Not just alternative media in the Christian rock and et cetera, in the Christian radio and the Christian political evangelical stuff, but Christian alternative education programs that whites need to develop on their own or adapt what already exists out there by putting in additional racial components, racial focus to it that the Christians don't have, because Christianity can be interpreted as something universalistic, which can mean either, certainly Christianity is universalistic as opposed to Judaism, which is tribalistic. Judaism is for Jews. And Jews are the chosen people, they claim. Whereas Christian, anybody, there's neither slave nor Greek nor free man nor Persian nor whatever. That can be interpreted as a way that they can all become good Christians while still keeping their race, but it can also be interpreted the other way, which race is something that should not be taken into account. And if you go to the PaleoCon sites, you'll find various disputants arguing over that stuff, over the right way to interpret what the Pope has said on race. Some popes say it's a race is of standard value. That means it has some value, but it's not everything. And others will make statements that are more amenable to a liberal interpretation that race doesn't matter, which, you know, is precisely the Jewish lie that governs our country and determines what's written in our textbooks. White, well, in fact, it's not even that race doesn't exist. It's that white exists as a repository for historical guilt, as we'll see in the next hour. But in every other way, there is no positive side to white racial identity. There's only a negative side. That's what your children are taught in public schools. So, all right, I think we've hit this pretty well, this public schooling. It's something we're going to continue to track. As I said, we have a home schooling threads in our learning section at vnnforum.com where you can where all this stuff is posted and you can get up to date on it and understand what it means to your kid. And the background authors, again, you want to read John Taylor Gatto and Samuel Blumenfelder, the two best that I know of. A third would be Charlotte Iserbyt. I think that's Iserbyt. And she has written a great deal about dumbing down and involving the involving teaching you, if you truly, you want to read these authors, if you want to understand public schooling as an institution and what it is designed to do, don't be stuck at the silly conservative level saying, our schools are failing. They're not failing. They're doing precisely what they're intended to do. Don't accept their claims at face value. Don't accept that their mission is to teach your kid. It is not. It is not their mission to teach your kid. It's their mission to make him conform to ideas and attitudes that are congenial to the true powers behind the state. And that means organized Jewry. That, we always give you the bottom line here, which you never get from the conservatives, even many of the Christian conservatives who either don't understand or fear to name the force that they are fighting when they withdraw their kids quite revolutionarily from the public schools. Now let's go to some music. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about Australia. How's that?
Yeah. you walk down the street, you're in Coontown. You look and see garbage all over the street, you're in Coontown. Up and down the street there ain't nothing but trash, nigger girls trying to get a nigger boy's cash. Then you even see a spook with a big mustache in Coontown. On the corner there's a nigger with a drink in his hand, that's Coontown. Trying to bum a nickel from whoever he can in Coontown. Now don't be surprised, you can make a bet, if you go back tomorrow he'll be there yet. He's trying to get drunk, and drunk he's gonna get in Coontown. Going to work in Coontown. They seem to think that work is for jerks out of Coontown. He don't do nothing but sleep and doze. He don't wake until his eyes are tired of being closed. It's half a day's work for him to scratch his toes in Coontown. It amazes me to see the way they live in Coontown. They do all the taking while we have to give to Coontown. The nightman worries, the nigger don't care, cause at the end of the month his check will be there. Every nigger earned his living off the old welfare in Coontown. Every nigger earned his living off the old welfare in Coontown.
Okay, children, quiet down, quiet down. Children, I'd like to introduce our new substitute teacher for the day. His name is Mr. Shady. Children, quiet down, please. Brian, don't throw that.
Shut up.
Mr. Shady will be your new substitute while Mr. Knipp is out with pneumonia.
He's got AIDS.
Good luck, Mr. Shady.
Hi there, little boys and girls. Today we're gonna learn how to poison some squirrels. But first, I'd like you to meet my friend Bob. Say hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Bob's 30 and still lives with his mom. He don't got a job. Bob sits at home and smokes pot. But his 12-year-old brother looks up to him an awful lot. And Bob likes to hang out at the local waffle spot and wait in the parking lot. But waitress is off the clock when it's late and the lot gets dark. And fake like he walks his dog. Drag him in the woods and go straight to the chopping block. And even if they escaped and they got the cops, the ladies would all be so afraid they would drop the charge. So one night, Mrs. Stacy went off the job when she felt someone grab her whole face and said not to talk. But Stacy knew it was Bob and said knock it off. But Bob wouldn't knock it off because he's crazy and off his rocker. Crazier than Slim Shady is off the locker. You couldn't even take him to Dre's to give Bob a doctor. He grabbed Stacy by the leg because he chopped it off her and dropped her off in the lake for the cops to punch. But ever since the day Stacy went off the wander, and they never found her, and Bob still hangs at the Waffle Diner. And that's the story of Bob and his marijuana and what it might do to you. So see if the squirrel's born in this patch.
See, children, drugs are bad. And if you don't believe me, ask your dad. And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she does them all the time. So kids say no with drugs, so you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad and
hurt. My penis is the size of a peanut. Have you seen it? Fuck no, you ain't seen it. It's the size of a peanut. Speaking of penis, you know what else is bad for squirrels? Ecstasy is the worst drug in the world. If someone ever offers it to you, don't do it. Kids, two hits will probably drain all your spinal fluid. And spinal fluid is final, you won't get it back. So don't get attacked, it'll attack every bone in your back. Meet Zach, 21 years old. After hanging out with some friends at a frat party, he gets bold and decides to try five when he's tried by five guys. The peer pressure will win every time you try to fight it. Suddenly, he starts to get bones and his pulse goes in a hyperdrive and his eyes roll back in his skull. His back starts to look like the McDonald's arches. He's on Donald's carpet laying horizontal barfing. And everyone in the apartment starts laughing at him.
Hey, Adam, Zach is a jackass. Look at him.
They took it too, but they think it's funny. kind of laughing and basically nothing except maybe wasting his money. Meanwhile, Zach's in a coma. The action is over and his back and his shoulders hunched up like he's practicing yoga. And that's the story of Zach, the ecstasy maniac. So don't even beat at this world's class. He'll have
six children from somebody. And if you don't believe me, ask your dad. And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she tells him all the time. So kids say no to drugs. So you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad and hurt.
And last but not least, one of the most humongous problems among young people today is fungus that grows from cow manure. They pick it out, wipe it off, bag it up, and you put it right in your mouth and chew it. Yum, yum. Then you start to see some dumb stuff, and everything slows down when you eat some of them. And sometimes you see things that aren't there, like fat women in G-strings with orange hair. Mr. Shady, what's a G-string? It's yarn, Claire. Women stick them up their behinds, go out and wear them, huh? And if you swallow too much of the magic mushrooms, whoops, did I say magic mushrooms? I meant fungus, your tongue gets all swollen up like a cow's tongue.
How come?
Cause it comes from a cow's dump. See, drugs are bad, it's a common fact. But your mom and dad, well, that's all that I'm good at. But don't be me, cause if you grow up and you go in OD, you're gonna come for me. And I'ma have to grow a goatee and get a disguise and hide, cause it'll be my fault. So don't do drugs and do exactly as I don't. Cause I'm mad for you.
See, children, drugs are bad. And if you don't believe me, ask your dad. And if you don't believe him, ask your mom. She'll tell you how she does them all the time. So kids, say no to drugs. So you don't act like everyone else does. And there's really nothing else to say. Drugs are just bad and good.
Come on, children. Clap along.
Yes.
Sing along, children.
Come on, clap along.
Drugs are just bad.
All right, and we got one more song left here. This song goes out to Ollie the Cat. Now, sadly, populating cat heaven, launching, no doubt, unprovoked attacks on people who didn't really deserve it. Nevertheless, this is in Ollie's honor. Here we go.
I would have given you all of my heart, but that someone is torn it apart. And she's taken almost all that I've got. But if you want, I'll try to love again. Baby, I'll try to love again, but I know. The first cut is the deepest. Baby, I know. The first cut is the deepest. Cause when it comes to being lucky, she's cursed. When it comes to loving me, she's worse. Want you by my side, just to help me dry the tears that I've cried. Cause I'm sure gonna give you a try. And if you want, I'll try to love again. But baby, I'll try to love again. But I know the first cut is lucky, she's cursed. When it comes to loving me, she's worse. But when it comes to being loved, she's first. That's how I know.
During that break, we played Raspberry Beret by Prince, Where You Get Love, Matthew Sweet, Heaven and Earth, Matthew Sweet, Johnny Rebel with Coontown, The Kids by Eminem, that's his anti-drug track, an anti-anti-drugger track. Finally, we concluded with The First Cut is the Deepest by Cat Stevens, in honor of Ollie, the late, great, departed cat. And let's see, now we're going to move into our second hour, and we're going to discuss, and this will be the last hour of the show today, we'll discuss the apology that was recently given in Australia to the Aboriginals. And we'll basically go into the Aboriginals and trace their past and trace how they're being used by the Jews to undermine white Australia, which is to say Australia proper. I'm going to read a little bit off of a recent news item. This was February 13th. Let me see here. I don't know if I have the... We'll just start in with the... This is a specifically Jewish take on it. I don't have a straight news article on it, so we'll do this. And what it is the new Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, issued a formal apology to the Aboriginals for the so-called Stolen Generation. Now, these are tens of thousands of Aboriginal children who were forcibly taken from their parents and stuck in white families. Out of the typically white, confused, but benevolent desire to improve their lot in life, the lot of these kids, because left with their parents in their Aboriginal population, they're subject to drunken rampages and sexual abuse, which are, to call them widespread does not go far enough in describing how common they are among Aborigines. Anyway, that's the news item, and this is the story of Jews in Australia and how they've attempted to inculcate guilt in white Australians in very much the same way they've attempted to do in the U.S. with regard to the descendants of the original slave populations brought over here by those very same Jews themselves, which of course they omit. And this is from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency from Sydney. Or Dateline Sydney, in relation to the apology issued in February of 2008, and we're recording this show on the 14th of February, I believe. The apology was issued on the 13th of February 2008. In what could be described as Australia's Yom Kippur, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd expressed Wednesday the one word his predecessors refused to utter to Indigenous Australians: sorry. Rudd's Labour Party wrested power from John Howard's Liberals last November on a platform that included apologizing to the, quote, stolen generation, up to 100,000 mostly mixed-blood Aboriginal children who were forcibly removed from their families between 1910 and 1970. And the text of the motion on the stolen generations, which won bipartisan support, acknowledged the, quote, profound grief, suffering, and loss, unquote, inflicted on Aborigines. Now, what we want to talk about for our purposes is what Jews have done in Australia. And we know, as I've been talking earlier, what we know about Jews is that they don't like settled white society. And one of their most effective tools for undermining white society is to bring the whites into a submissive relation, morally and legally, in relation to any non-white people they can dredge up. Now, in the case of Australia, the material they have at hand to work with is the so-called Aborigines, the Aboriginals. And in Australia, those truly were the first people, if you want to call them that, to inhabit the land. Now, today there are about 200,000 to 460,000 Australian Aborigines living in Australia, which is a nation of some 22 million people. So they're about a little more than 2% of the population. They're, I say 200,000 to 450,000 because you find different estimates. Now, typically what the Jews do, what leftists always do in relation to Aborigines and Indians and First Nation, call them what you will, as they're variously called in Canada, the U.S., and Australia, is exaggerate the numbers. I had a professor, so-called, in college, a female colored professor, who claimed there were 100 million Indians in the Americas when the white man showed up. And, you know, I said, you know, how in the world can you tell that? And she didn't have an answer for it. I mean, there's no way that people who were eating ants and acorns, as many Indians were, can survive in numbers to demand apologies. There just simply were not any 100 million Americans. So what 100 million so-called Native Americans, and they weren't Native, whites were there before they were, but that's for another day. What we have here is, you know, as the Jews say, up to 100,000 mostly mixed blood children were taken from their family. The truth is there's probably 10 or 20,000 of them. And it was, you know, the whites trying to be fair, trying to help these kids out, and of course they get the blame for that later on. You can never be right when you're white is the Jewish motto towards white people. No matter if they do this, they're guilty. They're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. But what we want to do here, this Jewish article provides a nice survey of Jewish leadership of the cause of race mixing and essentially subverting white interests. Now, you know, there's a Reconciliation Australia, and look who's ahead of it. Why, it's a Mark Liebler, or Leibler, L-E-I-B-L-E-R, the co-chair of Reconciliation Australia, said Rudd's apology marked a watershed in Australian history, but that this should just be the beginning of the reconciliation process. See, this is how the Jew operates. First, he gets you to apologize. So once you've agreed that you've done wrong, why, then you have to make restitution. Isn't that the natural number two? Just like if they ever get America to apologize for the slaves, well, what's the next thing they do? Well, they demand reparations. They demand 40 acres and a mule. They demand payments for all time and eternity. Basically, all the mud races and the Jews think they are owed by whites. Whites who gave them everything of value that they have. The Aborigines, according to Richard Lynn, the world's foremost expert on IQ, have an IQ of 62. That's not even as high as the sub-Saharan blacks in Africa who can't sustain civilization. Aborigines, you know, they're celebrated in the film as these wonderful, close-to-nature people who can do X, Y, and Z that the white man can't. All they're really able to do is flip over rocks and pick up grubs. Okay? So, everything that they have is basically owed to whites if they like indoor living, and they certainly like alcohol. So let's not kid ourselves here. So what they want to do, the Jew harasses the white until the, okay, we're guilty, I guess. We'll apologize to them, all right. Well, that's the start of the mulcting of the white taxpayer. Not the start, it's the increase. They're already giving these people all kinds of money. I mean, there's a so-called joke email circulating that tells the truth of the matter. As you know, jokes usually are based in truth or they're not funny. Let me just read that quickly because it's posted here at VNN Forum in the Australia section, under the Australian Aborigines thread. And this is the true apology that ought to be extended to the Aboriginal peoples. White Australia's apology to the Aboriginal population. We apologize for giving you doctors and free medical care, which allows you to survive and multiply so that you can demand apologies. We apologize for helping you to read and teaching you the English language, thus opening up to you the entire European civilization, thought, and enterprise. We feel that we must apologize for building hundreds of homes for you, which you have vandalized and destroyed, just like American blacks in 8A housing. We apologize for giving you law and order, which has prevented you from slaughtering one another and using the unfortunate for food purposes, i.e. cannibalism. We apologize for developing large farms and properties, which today feed you, where before you had the benefits of living off the land and starving during droughts. We apologize for providing you with warm clothing made of fabric to replace the animal skins you used before. We apologize for building roads and the railway tracks between cities and building cars so that you no longer have to walk over harsh terrain. We apologize for paying off your vehicles when you fail to pay installments. I don't know what that refers to, but I guarantee it refers to something factual.
We apologize for giving you free travel anywhere, wherever, whenever. We apologize for giving each and every member of your family $100 and free travel to attend an Aboriginal funeral. These are all the benefits that Aborigines get in Australia that are denied to white taxpayers, yet funded by white taxpayers. So you pay, they play. It's the law, not only in America, not only in Canada, but in Australia too. Anywhere that whites are and Jews are, Jews have taken control of the media and the legislatures, and they forced whites to subsidize colonies of those who will destroy them, all because it's good for Jews. So whatever is good for Jews is bad for you, white man. That's the message that you take from this and every story that we bring you here at Radio Istina, which is the opposite of Radio Pravda, which is another name for the Fox News Network, right? Pravda is the should truth, the unreality truth, the utopian dream, or the nightmare of the Marxist brought to bear on you. Radio Istina is the is truth. These are two opposed Russian words, Pravda and Istina. Istina is the is reality. It is, not what some evil Jew thinks should be and tries to impose on you out of his noggin, but the is reality of the street where Aboriginals are 62 IQ, drunken, incestuous, child-molesting scum. But this joke email has the truth that they're subsidized. And I got about half through it, but there's a few more. So apparently white Australians pay when Aborigines don't pay the installments on their loans. Abos are given free travel. They're given free travel and $100 to attend their own funerals, the funerals of their people. We apologize for not charging you any rent on lands when white people have to pay. We apologize for giving you interest-free loans. We apologize for developing oil wells and minerals, including gold and diamonds, which you never used before we arrived because you had no idea of their value. We apologize for developing Ayers Rock and Kakadu and handing them over to you so that you may get all the money. Those are, I guess, tourist attractions somehow related to Aborigines. We apologize for allowing taxpayers' money to be paid toward the daughter's wedding. $8,000 per daughter. Is that amazing or what? We apologize for giving you $1.7 billion a year for your 250,000 people, which is $48,000 per Aboriginal man, woman, and child. Unbelievable. We apologize for working hard to pay taxes that finance your welfare, medical care, education to the tune of $1.2 billion each year. We apologize for you having to approach the Aboriginal Affairs Department to verify the above figures. For the trouble you will have in identifying the Uncle Toms in your community who are getting richer and leaving some of you living in squalor and poverty. We do apologize. Squalor and poverty. We do apologize. We really do. We are only too happy to take back all of the above and return you to the paradise of the, quote, outback whenever you are ready. So already before this apology, we see that Aboriginals are subsidized lavishly. $8,000 per wedding for Aboriginal daughters. They get free health, education, and welfare. They get free travel money. All kinds of benefits that are funded by whites but denied whites. Can you imagine how much better white society would be if there were no colored parasites nor Jews to stick them on us? This is absolutely outrageous. New Americans, pay attention. The same thing is going on in Australia as is going on in England, in Canada, in France, in Germany, wherever you look. Racism is a big problem, but as Bob Whitaker says, only in white lands. Every other land is allowed to keep and maintain its original culture, but not white lands. They are forced to admit outsiders who are going to destroy them, because that is the policy of the Jews who actually control these countries. Conservatives will never tell you the plain truth, but it is. It's Jews who are at the bottom of this. People with 62 IQ are a headless community. They can't do anything on their own. They need people speaking for them and creating these policies on their behalf. The Jews in Australia are working just as they do here, and we'll go into that right now. And it's proved by this Jewish article. They take credit for this stuff. So you've got Reconciliation Australia, headed by a Jew named Mark Liebler. I'm going to guess it's pronounced. In German it would be Liebler, but I'm guessing it's Liebler. And he says, new Prime Minister Rudd's apology marked a watershed, but it should be just the beginning of the reconciliation progress. Translation, whites are going to be asked to cough up increasing amounts of money to subsidize these Aboriginals. And note that above, in the so-called joke email circulating, it's claimed there are 250,000 Aborigines, whereas the Jewish report claims there's 460,000. So how could there be that big of a disparity in counting these animals? Either there's a quarter million or there's half a million. They don't know. I mean, sounds like the Holocaust to me. They claim 6 million. The reality is a few tens of thousands. Oh, the other reality is 60 million whites who actually died in World War II compared to 6 million imaginary Jews who died. Pretty amazing, huh? Here we go. What we're trying to show here is the parallel Jewish undermining everywhere in the white world. There is a counterpart, whether it's in Europe, in America, or Australia. And here's the classic Jew Jewing. Liebler is also the chairman of the World Board of Trustees of Karen Hayesod, United Israel Appeal, and national chairman of the Australia/Israel and Jewish Affairs Council. We've suffered 2,000 years of persecution, and we understand what it is to be the underdog and suffer from disadvantage, she said. Jews have been at the forefront of pushing for civil rights in Australia, right? And we know that civil rights is Jewish tyranny. It undermines free association. It forces whites to subsidize their racial enemies. Now, again, the Jewish publication, JTA. In 1965, Jim Spiegelman, cousin of the Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Art Spiegelman, remember those crappy mouse comic books used in a lot of schools? Jim Spiegelman, the cousin of Art, led 30 students on the first Australian Freedom Ride in 1965, the exact same time they had the Freedom Rides in the U.S., right? Where they go down south and they try to destroy the southern way of life, destroy states' rights, and destroy free association that allowed whites to protect themselves from the niggers who were, in many of those states, practically 50% of the population. Who's leading the so-called freedom rights that tyrannize and enslave whites? Why, it's Jews. It was Jews in the south. A quarter of all the civil rights workers were Jews, and all the leaders were Jews, almost to a one. Just like all the student radicals, with the exception of Irish Catholic Tom Hayden, were Jews. So this campus unrest was wholly a Jewish phenomenon, and so was the so-called Freedom Rides and the Civil Rights Movement in Australia and here. And the radical revolutions in Europe at the same time, also they're Jew communists, trying to Judaize these countries and make them amenable to Jewish dictatorship. And that's exactly what happened. So, in 1965, this Jew, Jim Spiegelman, is leading students on a so-called Freedom Ride, a journey into outback Australia to protest racial discrimination against Aborigines who were not entitled to vote and who were prohibited from swimming pools, pubs, and other public places. Well, why would you want people who are literally retarded? 70 is like the level of retardation. How can you have retarded people voting? Does that make any kind of sense whatsoever? Only to a Jew who's trying to dominate a country and lacks numbers does it make any kind of sense. In the country town of Moree, a racist mob attacked the students, and according to newspaper reports at the time, Spiegelman was smacked to the ground. There's another mistake whites have consistently made. To some extent, they physically went after these marchers and these evil destroyers and usurpers and tyrants, but the mistake they made was in not killing them. They didn't kill them. And most they maybe beat them or jeered at them or threw a rock at them. That's not good enough. You have to kill these Jews. You have to physically exterminate them, because the policies they put in place are intended and will in time exterminate your people. It's that serious. It's not something that can be talked down or negotiated away. It's a violent battle between different kinds of animals. That must be understood. Now, the context in Australia is you've got a giant, you know, America-sized, continental-sized island, or just simply a continent. But it's very old and low-quality dirt. There are very few rivers of any size on it. And so the population is essentially in a strip on the eastern coast. That's where most of the people are. And then there's a little bit on the far western coast. In between is a vast, massive place called the Outback that's pretty much inhospitable. As I said, the dirt is very thin, it's very old, it doesn't really grow that much. A little bit of ranching and sheep farming, that's pretty much all they can do with it right now. And that's where the Aborigines lived. And there weren't very many of them. There weren't as many as they claim. And what happened was, it has been populated by Aborigines for at most 70,000 years. And as I said, they always exaggerate in the favor of the mud races. So, the oldest artifact they found in Australia is so-called Mungo Man, so you could call the Aboriginals the Munganese if you wanted to be funny. the Munganese have only been there for 40,000 years is as far back as they can date them, and then some claim 70,000. But anyway, probably tens or a few hundred thousand of these existed when the British showed up in 1788, and they started dumping Irish convicts and prison scum in Australia. And, you know, just as I've often said about Kirksville, even though we have an arsonist and drunks in our town council, we still run a budget in the black, and we still maintain roads in a civilized little city of 17,000. Well, that's how it was there. You had scum of the British Empire was sent there. They still managed to build a civilized, beautiful society. So that even the lowest level whites are fundamentally civilized, whereas not even the top level niggers are civilized. So the races are unequal, and that should be reflected in any kind of law. The fact that certain characteristics of the white soul or the white spirit or the white mentality or the white biological being can be exploited by intelligent parasites to create and foster the widespread belief that these lower level people can be integrated is a great danger to us and has to be watched out for. And it was that kind of thinking that led to the so-called stolen generation. They're thinking, well, maybe they bought into some of the lies being spread in America by Franz Boas about race not mattering and culture being everything. Maybe they thought, well, okay, all we have to do is take away these 62 IQ aboriginals from their drunken, abusive families and stick them with white families, and we'll breathe them out of existence, and or we'll make civilized men of them. But it didn't work. It never works. Races are different, and those who claim they aren't are alchemists. Those who claim race doesn't matter are alchemists. They're trying to turn lead into gold, just the way ancient philosophers tried to. You can't turn lead into gold. So racial alchemy worked no better in Australia than it worked anywhere else. All it did was destroy the native race. To the extent Aborigines and then later on coloreds led in from Lebanon and from Asia, lots of Muslims, all they do is destroy the white race, and that is the intent of the Jews who are dominating the immigration process. So they work with the material they have at hand, Aborigines, and then they import further additional clay materials to work with to mess up the white population. That's how the Jews do things. And white Australia, like America, had a white Australia immigration policy, and Jews were at the forefront of overturning that in Australia, just as they were in the U.S. U.S. 1924, against strong Jewish opposition, and these kikes had barely been in the country 20 years, and they were calling us racists and nativists and evil white Nordics, and claiming we were Nordic supremacists. Against that already strong opposition, whites were able to prevail in 1924 and stave off third world swamping that occurred after the Jews got enough power to overturn the 1924 Act in 1965 in America. And by gosh and by gory, about the same time in Australia, they reversed their white Australia immigration policy, and their immigration became colored. Think about it. The same problems have the same causes no matter where you look in the white West. And the cause is the Jew. And anyone who won't tell you that is not a white nationalist, and is not your friend. He's either a coward, a fool, or a shill. Now, we talked about Jim Spiegelman, cousin of prize-winning cartoonist of Mouse, Art Spiegelman. He's leading Freedom Rides. And then there's another Jew also who figured prominently. The man most Jews and Aborigines hail as having made the greatest contribution to the cause of Aboriginal rights is Ron Caston. R-O-N-C-A-S-T-A-N. Ron Caston, a Jewish Australian dubbed by Aboriginal leaders as the, quote, Great White Warrior. Note the irony. Castron, who died in 1999, was the lead counsel in the landmark 1992 Australian Supreme Court Mabo judgment, named for plaintiff Eddie Mabo, Mabo or Mabo, which overturned the legal fiction that Australia was terra nullius, or uninhabited land, when white settlers first arrived in 1788. Aborigines now own more than 10% of Australia's landmass, so understand that. What it is basically courts in Australia treat Aborigines as animals, as fauna, because they had no existing system of title. They were just Indians, you know, scampering around, flipping rocks and looking for grubs. And so the legal principle of that is terra nullius. That means an unoccupied land. And the Jews, of course, Jews always flock to law schools and dominate law schools so that they can get judges in place who will enforce their edicts, interpret the law the way the Jews find it favorable. And what they did in Australia, that meant reversing the terra nullius. And so that lays the basis for the Aboriginals to make property claims, fill the courts with, yay, this is our land, it was stolen from us. Well, they didn't have any concept of land ownership the way that that whites do, and it was the same thing in America. The red men who killed off the original white inhabitants of America had no concept of territorial rights whatsoever. They simply warred with warring tribes. They would go from here to there. They didn't live in one place. So, in his 1998 speech, Jew Kasten, implored the government to say it was sorry, citing the Holocaust denial in his argument. The refusal to apologize for dispossession, for massacres, and for the theft of children is the Australian equivalent of the Holocaust deniers, those who say it never really happened, Kasten charged. In 1999, Howard proposed a motion expressing deep and sincere regret. So the Jews have been after this. They're persistent. They keep after this stuff for years and years and years. And now 10 years later, it's, you know, 10, 20 years later, they finally got the whites to knuckle under and declare that they're sorry. They've gotten rid of the principle that this was uninhabited land before whites showed up. So they've laid the basis for endless property claims and forced remunerations and subsidization of these muds by the whites, who created the whole thing in the first place. There was no indoor plumbing, electricity, or any of the stuff that we associate with living as a civilized person before whites showed up. They built it all themselves as prison scum. These rapists, these murderers, these deadbeats coming over from England and Ireland, they built Australia fair. And now, their descendants are being forcibly terrorized and taxed to subsidize these columns of rock-flipping grub-eaters. All because they're allowing the Jews to come in as private individuals and unmake their society. And the Jews lie. Aborigines number about 450,000 in an Australian population of 21 million. Well, we see various claims. Is it 450K or is it 200K? Who knows? And then again, you know, always the perverse presentation of data. They are the most disadvantaged group in Australia, suffering high rates of infant mortality, unemployment, alcohol abuse, and domestic violence. Well, they're suffering those because they're causing those. The correct focus is they are causing these problems to themselves. But they're always, minorities are always presented as passive victims of a white system that the Jews are trying to destroy. It always must be put legally enshrined that whites are responsible for every color defect, and they must be browbeaten eternally through the school textbooks, as we discussed earlier. You know, oh, the poor homos. They're denied the right to cavort in bathhouse and bar before the civil rights revolution. Oh, these poor 60 IQ rock-flipping grub-eaters. They were denied equality. Well, they're not equal. Why would you give them equality? So whites are blamed for the problems of coloreds and called racist if they point out the truth. Now listen to this. Here's what I was talking about earlier. In addition to their activism on Aboriginal issues, Jews were instrumental in leading the crusade against the White Australia Policy, a series of laws from 1901 to 1973 that restricted non-white immigration to Australia. Interesting. So in both Australia and America, you had whites passing laws protecting the white majority. They want a white founding stock to be the majority of the country. And in both of those countries, you have Jews working to overturn that law, to fill the country with muds who they know will terrorize the whites. Jews know when they loose the niggers into white communities, they know there's going to be tens of thousands of rapes per year. Jews want white women and girls to be raped by these niggers. They know that that demoralizes, scares, terrifies, and reduces the white breeding rate. They know that. Jews are evil. They're evil, and so are those who shill for them. I'm talking to you, Ann Coulter. I'm talking about you, Sean Hannity. I'm talking to you, Rush Limbaugh. I'm talking to you, Mike Huckabee, who's been over to Israel 8 times and won't stick up for his own place. You know, Mike Huckabee went out shucking and jiving in front of a group of Mexi shits the other day, and he joked, oh, sometime white guys like me will be in the minority. You know what we had on VNNforum.com today?
some Mexican there who's hired as a teacher molested a four-year-old. That's what we get by not having real political leaders. We have people who are too cowardly to stand up for their own people. They truckle before the Jews in Australia just as in America. And I'm telling you about the horror that this produces in the native population. So we've got the Jews, and again, I'm taking this from a Jewish source, the JTA, Jewish Telegraphic Agency. From a Jewish source, they are saying we are the ones who overturned the immigration policy and brought in these people who are attacking whites. And let's leave it there for right now on the Aboriginal crime in Australia. The point is, just to recapitulate, as we recapitulated public education in the U.S., it's a transition from freedom to excessive government, to government taken over by Jews, to Jews passing anti-white measures across the board in foreign and domestic policy. So what you have is 70 to 40,000 years ago, you've got Aborigines, and they've got 62 IQ, and they flip over rocks to find grubs to eat, and that's how they live. 1788, the British establish a penal colony in what's today Sydney. And whites start coming in, and they have white-only immigration laws until the Jews were able to overturn that, I believe, in the early 70s or the late 60s. At the same time, 1967, in a referendum, Australians voted to count Aborigines in the census, granting them votes, voting rights, and ending constitutional discrimination. So this stuff was around as late as the late 60s. This is the same time that the U.S. repealed laws against, say, racial intermarriage. So the same type of changes are happening across the Western world at the same time, and they have the same cause. Jews looking to subvert white societies and make them more hospitable to ordinary Jewish living, or just plain Jewish parasitism, Jewish evil, Jews being privileged over whites. Jews claiming their victims, yet being the richest ethnic group in every one of these societies, owning the middle part of every major city, yet somehow they're persecuted against. No, it's the whites who are the victims. And so the reason we're talking about this today is in 2008, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has issued a formal apology. Just as we've seen in America, you know, we've started to see formal apologies for slavery. One apology we'll never see is an apology for Jews for being the majority of the slave ship owners. So the people who brought the slaves to America were Jews, but do you think they'll ever apologize for that or even admit to it? No, that fact is totally excluded from history. You have to go to blacksandjews.com and find Louis Farrakhan, who documented this. He had his researchers go to Jewish sources and dig up the facts about the slave ship owners. And guess what? They ain't whites, they're Jews. Jews totally dominated the slave trade. That's a little thing they will never tell you. So, with that, let's listen to a little more music, and then we'll come back and we'll do a third and final segment. Just a little bit about some of the lies of the ATF, because that's preparatory to an interview we're going to conduct here that just may make some mainstream news. But right now, let's listen to three or four songs, and then I'll come back and we'll wrap it up. So what we have, let's search here. What do we want to listen to? Start off with some Rolling Stones.
I see the girls go by dressed in their summer. paints it go turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
Royal. sounded good. Shut up.
We'll be right back.
Okay, and we're back. That break we played Painted Black by the Rolling Stones, Pennyroyal Tea by the late Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. What did we play after that? I forget what it was. Joan Jett, Bad Reputation, and then Tenderness by General Public. Pretty good song. Now, something has just come to my attention. I'm going to bring it up because it points out the hypocrisy and the hate of the Jewish community and their proclivity for lying, which is, it's more than a proclivity. It's kind of their whole raison d'etre. Their reason for being is to tell lies. Now, here's what it says in a Jewish publication. You think of this, and then you think of what I'm going to read. This is a Jew publication, Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Jews were instrumental in leading the crusade against white Australia policy, a series of laws from 1901 to 1973 that restricted non-white immigration to Australia. Okay, so Jews are bragging that they helped overturn that law. They were instrumental in it. And it was exactly the same thing in America. But when we resent that, they go after us as haters and extremists. And in particular, they go after the PhDs who have proved that to be the case. Proved to be the case what Jews freely admit to, indeed brag about in their own publications. That's how hypocritical and dishonest Jews are. Article, Hate in Their Midst. And this is Inside Higher Ed, which is a notoriously corrupt and controlled piece of crap that, along with the Chronicles of Higher Education, gives a semitically correct view of what is and should be happening in academia. They say, Scholars Hate in Their Midst is the title, of course, so you know you're getting a good, honest, objective treatment. Scholars, documentary producers, and genocide survivors. You know, I don't mean to interrupt myself, but if you or I went into Israel and started advocating the admission of Muslims because making it a Jews-only state was racist and evil and it should be overturned, how do you think they would treat that? You think they'd treat you as someone wonderful and noble and leading a civil rights crusade? Or would they say exactly what we're saying about they're doing in the U.S.? They're trying to undermine us. They're trying to undermine the Jewish nature of our society. They're trying to destroy us. Well, of course, that's exactly what they would say. Every step of the way, Jews are hypocrites, liars, thieves, and murderers. They are complete parasites upon the Aryan body politic. Scholars, documentary producers, and genocide survivors have gathered at the California State University at Long Beach this week for the President's Forum on International Human Rights. Blah, 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 blah. This is Long Beach, is where Kevin McDonald teaches, and they say, participants report that the sessions have been engaging and intense, and the gathering is being praised for focusing attention. I apologize for having a little bit of trouble with the sound today. I'm trying to get it to where it's equalized, and I don't have to keep moving it up and down depending on which song we have playing or whether we have music or voice. So if there's some kind of problem with it, you got to let me know. But what we got now is, We're gonna deal with this article that's attacking, essentially an attack on Kevin McDonald that mentions VNN by name. And then we're gonna move into Ambrose Evans Pritchard's The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. And we'll talk just a little bit about some of the lies put out by the ATF. That'll be kind of our part one of dealing with that book. So, big conference here at Cal State Long Beach, and they're denouncing all the usual evils of genocide, racism, blah, 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 what have you. And then they say, but maybe the Cal State Long Beach needs to look a little closer to home. Also this week, a white supremacist website. See, there's no legitimate neutral term to decide those who defend and advocate white interests. Called Vanguard News Network, its motto is No Jews, Just Right, drew attention to an article in the Long Beach student paper about how some professors there want more distance between the institution and a psychology professor, Kevin McDonald, who has applied evolutionary psychology to studying Jews in ways that scholars find offensive and inaccurate. That is, he looks at Jewish interest as something that can be opposed to other people's interest and finds that, yes, in fact, they are opposed, and they're diametrically opposed. That is, whatever Jews want the opposite of whatever is good for whites. What is good for Jews is bad for whites, and that's across the board. And that's what his research has showed. That's why he's hated, despised, ridiculed, ostracized, and attacked by Jews in the media. So he's guilty of basically applying evolutionary science to the study of Jews.
In other words, he's guilty of reporting to Gentiles what Jews say about themselves and their motivations and their own media, as we just proved. They work to reverse the White Australia policy just as they work to reverse the White America policy. Well, it wasn't called by that name, but it was the same policy passed in 1924, and MacDonald has documented that in a long essay you can find linked at VNN. GoVNN.com or VanguardNewsNetwork.com. Now, to continue, MacDonald argues, with backing from Vanguard News Network, that Jewish people band together in part to undercut white society in the United States. Well, we've just proved that. If they're trying to undercut white Australia and they're doing the same thing in the U.S., then there's no doubt they are trying to undercut it. They say it in so many words in their own publications. He says that they do this in part by supporting immigrants with the idea that letting more Latinos into the country would advance Jewish interests by weakening the country. And that is exactly true. Jews have controlled immigration in the U.S. for a long time. They've controlled its treatment in the mass media for a long time. And you'll never, ever see mass media ever talk about the Jewish connection to open borders. But it's the only connection that matters. You ever hear Lou Dobbs? He's the most famous anti-immigration person in the mass media. He never talks about the Jewish connection, how they want diversity because it makes the country good for Jews, even though it results in 40,000 whites being raped a year by blacks. They never talk about any of that. But the Jewish connection is the only one that matters in understanding why these immigration policies are reversed in white country after white country at exactly the same time, in the 1960s. Not surprisingly, Vanguard Network, News Network views with alarm the idea that professors at Long Beach are talking about taking a stand against MacDonald. One commenter wrote, "Warning, offensive language ahead." So the goddamn kikes are getting their way yet again, putting the thumbscrews to a white scholar whose ass they are not worthy to lick. At least this oppression proves that Professor MacDonald's great work is hitting the scum hard. How much more of this humiliation is our race going to take? How long before this motherfucking plague of repulsive hooked-snouted ticks is given a real Zyklon fumigation as opposed to a fairy tale one? That is unmistakably the work of our own N.B. Forrest. There's many letters of grace the pages of VNN. I guess he left that comment at VNNforum.com, where we encourage you listening to this, maybe hearing the truth for the first time in your life, are encouraged to join. VNNforum.com. This is talking about our main page, VanguardNewsNetwork.com, GoVNN.com, VNNforum.com. They'll all feed you to the right place. And all of our radio shows are archived by our great archivist, who put this stuff up quickly so it can circulate forever, even as the Jews are trying to end the First Amendment. Now, after reading that letter from N.B. Forrest, other commenters linked to the websites of some of MacDonald's critics on the Long Beach faculty and or those with Jewish-sounding names, plus a list of phone numbers of the psychology department. So they're horrified when you try to do to them what they do to us routinely. And we got into it once more in the pages of Inside Higher Ed with Eugene Volokh, who's someone who's a associate of LouRockwell.com, and he talks about the First Amendment. We talked about Jews being the main force going against it. We talked about the Jewish domination of law schools, and he was very cocky on his website, talking about how they'd smash us Nazi scum for pointing out that Jews are basically 50% of the top 10 law school professoriate. They don't like it when you talk about Jews having power and what they're doing to other people. Their whole game is to portray themselves as victims rather than persecutors. We are telling you the truth because we are white, normal people like you. And this is the only place you're going to get it. MacDonald has taught at Long Beach in 1985 and periodically attracts attention. And while he has fans on sites like Vanguard News Network, says that he does not back what is said there about him and those comments don't help his cause. Well, he can say that. He may feel it's necessary to distance himself, even though he has a PhD, but the fact is, we are the ones who have popularized MacDonald before anyone else, because we understand the political meaning of what he's saying, which is that Jews are the cause of all of our national problems. They are the source of our national decline, and until we take on the Jews and defeat them, nothing significant will change in the United States. All of the evil trends we now experience will grow worse. Worse invasion, more crazy, insane foreign wars. More shills fronting for the Jews masquerading as American candidates. Yeah, that means you, John McCain. More diversity, more multiculturalism. All that stuff is anti-white, and it will only continue until we take out the cause of it, the force, the driving power behind it, as Winston Churchill said. Even the guy that the neocon kikes put up as the greatest man of the last 1,000 years said exactly the same thing we are about the Jews before he allowed himself to be purchased by them to stave off bankruptcy and carry their water as prime minister. He said they are the driving power behind communism. They're the ones who think it up. They're the ones who execute it. By execute, I mean they execute tens of millions of whites who stand athwart them in their commicidal dreams. And, you know, honestly, this is the first time I'm reading this article, so that's as far as I want to go with it right now. But just to say that there is an organized attack on Professor McDonald at Cal State Long Beach. He is a tenured PhD professor there. They're not going to be able to drive him out of a job, so what they're going to do is put forward an official institutional announcement that they disagree with his scholarship. Except they don't disagree with it because it's factual. There's nothing to disagree with. They're going to say that they disagree with his findings and just pretend that they don't exist. Even though, as we have proved on this segment of Radio Istina, Jews themselves in their own publications brag about the exact same thing these Jews are calling him a hater for expressing. That they intend to undermine, to undercut white society using immigration as a tool to destroy white nations. So which is it, Jews? You're braggarts and you're liars. Are you right when you're bragging or are you right when you're complaining? They cry, they whine, they lie, they murder, they steal. These are the Jews. God's chosen people. Only the God of evil chose the Jews. Now let's leave it alone. We'll come back to this some other time. We'll write more about this on VNNforum.com. And of course, basically what it amounts to, and I encourage everybody to go to this and leave a comment, because Jews really are hypocrites, and if they let the comment stand, it'll provide some backup and some support for McDonald, who has proved what the Jews are up to, which you can do yourself in a layman's way simply by reading publications intended for Jewish eyes rather than the publications they produce for goyish eyes. Now, let's go to Let's take a little turn here and let's go to the Secret Life of Bill Clinton by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. And what I want to do is just go a few pages in and read some of the things he says and to get us in the mood for relearning about Oklahoma City. But first I'm going to play one song right here. So, enjoy.
To the trains I miss, the loves I lost, the bridges I burned, the rivers I never crossed. Here's to the call I didn't hear, the signs I didn't heed, the roads I couldn't take, the map that I just wouldn't read. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. It's to the trains I miss. I've been a clown, I've been a fool, and I pushed on every chance. I searched far and wide, trying to crawl out of God's hands. But there were stones I didn't throw, and hearts I didn't break, and a little hope I held on to with a silver shining thread of faith. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. And here's to the train to this place I found, the love I know, the earth and the sky,
did I call her? And here's to the things I believe, bigger than me, and the moments I find myself right where I'm supposed to be. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. Yeah. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. Here's to the trains I missed.
Back. That was Walt Wilkins with Trains I've Missed. Now we're going to the last segment of the show, and it's not going to be too awful long. We're just going to cover a little bit. Book I want you all to read is called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, The Unreported Stories by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Now, this guy is a world-traveling reporter. He was in South America. I met him when he'd come back from there and was just starting to report on the U.S., and this is kind of the culmination of his reporting before he went back, and I believe he's based in Europe now. He's an English guy. Pretty observant. Now, he's a Tory. He's more or less Semitically correct. He never gets to the Jewish root of these problems, but he does cover the symptoms more carefully than almost any other mainstream reporter because he gets out and talks to regular people. What he found in covering these hidden stories of the Clinton years is essentially dovetails into white nationalist concerns because it shows the corruption and the politicization of the FBI, the ATF, and the Department of Justice, and the way they're used by the administration essentially to produce events that create the right climate in the country for the imposition of anti-terrorism and anti-free speech and anti-gun law. And we, of course, now everything's blocked out and we only think of 9-1-1, the demolitions of the World Trade Center buildings, the three of them that came down. But before then, a kind of the warm-up act was Oklahoma City. The bombing of the Oklahoma City building, and there was far more to that than people know, and we're in fact going to have an exclusive interview coming up in the next couple of weeks with someone who is very close to all that. But short of that, let's start off and dig into some of this, and this requires reacquainting ourselves with the Clintons, who may very well become the next president. And you remember how bad they were the first time around. I mean, it's hard to remember in light of how terrible Bush has been, but they were not good. They were really, really pretty bad, in fact. Now, let's see here. All right, so The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, published by Regnery, a kind of a right-wing, semi-neocon, semi-traditional conservative publishing house set up by a German-American back during World War II, famous conservative house, the most famous conservative imprint out there, books from 1997. Just to give you a sense of Evans Pritchard's ideas. Dedicated to the people of Arkansas who deserve better, the people of Oklahoma who deserve the truth, to the people of the United States who treated me with such generosity. And this is basically a skinny, observant Englishman who has more experience around the world than pretty much anyone. And the book has basically three parts. One part talks about Oklahoma. That's what we're going to deal with, just the first section of that today. Other part deals with Vince Foster, and the final part deals with Arkansas, MENA, Arkansas, and the drug dealing carried off by the CIA and Bush and Clinton, and used to fund, create slush funds and fund different projects of theirs. But today what we just want to cover, once we get past the introduction, is the lies of the ATF. Just show you how brazen our government actually is and rebuild the steam that they took out of us by producing the event called the Oklahoma City bombing. And they did produce it, just as the neocons produced 9-1-1 to get us into a war, a global war against what they call Islamofascism. Now he says, in his introduction, he says,
He says, by elective affinity, I'm an American, even if I remain a subject of the Queen. So the guy, his point is, I like America. I report honestly. I go talk to real people. I don't just circulate in D.C. and repeat the stories that appear in the New York Times and the Washington Post. He says, the Clintons are attractive on the surface. As Yale Law School graduates, they have mastered the language and style of the Mandarin class. It is only when you walk through the mirrors in the Arkansas underworld whence they came that you begin to realize that something is horribly wrong. You learn that Bill Clinton grew up in the Dixie Mafia stronghold of Hot Springs, and that his brother was a drug dealer with ties to the Medellin cartel. You learn that a cocaine distributor named Dan Lassiter was an intimate friend, and that Lassiter's top aide would later be given a post in charge of administration and drug testing at the White House. You learn that Arkansas was a mini Colombia within the U.S. infested by narco-corruption. And you start to wonder. In Washington, Clinton moved with ruthless efficiency to take control of the federal machinery of coercion. While the U.S. watchdog press barked and howled with pitiful irrelevance about Clinton's $200 haircut, he quietly fired every U.S. attorney in the country and then made his move on the FBI, which would be transformed gradually, one appointment at a time, into a replica of the Arkansas State Police. So that basically you've got people who swear personal loyalty to Clinton. When he sacked William Sessions in July 1993, it was the first time in American history that a president had summarily dismissed an FBI director. The putsch passed without protest. This is how a country starts to lose a democracy. He says, I have not lost my faith in the American people. In the end, I believe it is the ordinary citizens who will cleanse the institutions of the country before they become irretrievably corrupt. They are the heroes of this book. He says, ultimately, this is an optimistic essay, a peon to the American spirit. But let me tell you, I am astounded by the bullying and deceitful conduct of the U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, and the other law enforcement agencies under this administration. No doubt there have been abuses in the past, but I believe the malfeasance has become systemic over the last 5 years, and this was written in 97. It is spreading down by example, lodging itself in the institutional apparatus of government, whether it is the Internal Revenue Service targeting foes of the president, or the Immigration and Naturalization Service expediting citizenship for Democrats voters in time for the 1996 elections, or the prostitution of the Lincoln bedroom. The Clinton reflex is in evidence everywhere. To put it with brutal honesty, you can sniff the pungent odors of decay in the American body politic. I expect this is what it smelt like in continental Europe in the 1920s, even as the boom rolled on. Now, he says, something about Bill Clinton, his ineffable caddishness, perhaps, is changing the political discourse of the country. Every year that he continues in power, he eats a little deeper into the eroded legitimacy of the political order. The importance of this cannot be exaggerated. Three-quarters of the American people now tell pollsters that they do not trust the government to do the right thing. If ever there was a time when a leader of stoic virtue was needed to restore the authority of national institutions, it is surely now. And this is before the George W. Bush administration of 8 years. And he starts talking about terrorism becoming a feature of daily life in America. And he gets into, I choose the movement. He's talking about the militia. The actions and character of President Clinton have engendered the most deadly terrorist movement in the industrialized world. I choose the word movement advisedly because I do not accept the Justice Department claim that Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh were acting alone when they killed 168 people in the Oklahoma Federal Building in April 1995. And he's exactly right about that. Of course, there was a whole terror cell, and it was set up and instigated by an agent provocateur brought in by the government agencies and their semi-private cat's paws, like the SPLC. We know that for a fact. When he says, America looks like a country that's flying out of control. Again, it is under Clinton that an armed militia movement involving tens of thousands of people has mushroomed out of the plain, an expression of dissent that is unparalleled since the Southern gun clubs before the Civil War. People do not spend their weekends with an SKS rifle drilling for guerrilla warfare against federal forces in a country that is at ease with itself. It takes very bad behavior to provoke the first simmerings of an armed insurgency, and the militias are unmistakably Clinton's offspring. Now, that's interesting. Now, it is my contention, and I believe we can prove, that the Oklahoma City bombings were produced, just as a movie is produced, by the government, by the Jew-dominated, Clinton-dominated government, precisely to take the steam out of the militia movement, which, together with the growth in right-wing radio and the Republican takeover of the House, and they're embarking on a 100-day campaign to cut down the government. All those things were undercut by this bombing. So, you know, cui bono? Who benefited from the bombing? Well, just as Israel was the beneficiary, Israel and the giant military contractors benefited from the World Trade Center demolitions. Clinton, the liberals, and the Jew-led left benefited from the blow-up of the Murrow building. In fact, they benefited so much, they put it in place. There were ATF agents, SPLC agents, FBI agents honeycombed all through Elohim City. All through there. And probably they are still there today. And when it all came down, what they tried to do is pin it all on Tim McVeigh and Nichols. But there was, in fact, a cell, and it had an agent provocateur in it. And that's what we'll get into as we get farther into this book. And some of that will be the subject of our upcoming exclusive interview also. But now, he says, so his point is that there's growing unease with Clinton, his corruption. It's leading people to form militias and practice with drilling with their SKS rifles in the country on the weekends. He says, which compels a question, what is it about the combustible chemistry of Bill Clinton that causes such reaction? What has he been doing to America? The original sin, I believe, was the FBI assault on the Branch Davidian community in Waco, Texas on April 19, 1993. At least 76 people were incinerated, most of them women and children, after FBI tanks went smashing through the walls of Mount Carmel. The death toll adds up to the worst tragedy precipitated by government action on American soil this century. You have to go back to the slaughter of 200 Sioux Indians at Wounded Knee in 1890 to find an abuse of power on this scale. Just like Waco, Wounded Knee was designated a, quote, battle by officials, and just like Waco, the victims were demonized as sexual deviants. Some methods never change. And that's true. The government uses the same tricks to go after people. Infants too young to use masks were subjected to 6 hours exposure to CS gas, a weapon banned in warfare under the Paris Convention on Chemical Weapons. The Justice Department plan, in effect, was to torture the children to force the surrender of the parents. There is expert opinion that some of the babies would have died from the gas alone without the fire, so I bristled when Attorney General Janet Reno testified to Congress that the raid would have been a success if the FBI had increased the dosage of chemical poison. It is my contention that every salient fact put forward by the Clinton administration about Waco is a lie. I do not believe that the Branch Davidians were stockpiling weapons for offensive action or any action. I do not believe that they ambushed the ATF as federal agents were peacefully trying to deliver a search warrant. I do not find the FBI account of the final conflagration to be remotely credible. Nobody has ever lost a day's pay for what happened. I am not suggesting a public flogging for the regular FBI and ATF agents who were just trying to do their job under difficult circumstances. That is not the way to resolve anything, nor am I suggesting that those responsible be put on trial for negligent infanticide. Not yet, at least, but there has to be a ritual expurgation of some kind if the open wound of Waco is ever to heal. What is missing is any sense of guilt or repentance, any admission that something terrible was done to the Branch Davidians. Quote, I do not think the United States government is responsible for the fact that a bunch of fanatics decided to kill themselves, was how Clinton responded at a press conference 2 days after the fire. This, too, was a lie, of course, a posthumous slander. Nothing is more undignified than the attempt by the White House and the Justice Department to exonerate their own conduct by falsely accusing the Davidians of murdering their children. That's what the government does. It falsely accuses people of murdering their own children after it busts in and burns them to death. The evidence does not support this outrageous claim. It is far more likely that the inflammable residue from the CS gas was ignited by accident, perhaps by a tank smashing into a fuel lantern. After all, the Davidians had their electricity cut off, so they had to use lanterns, or by flashbang grenades or other explosive devices used by the FBI. But to admit that the U.S. Justice Department killed these children, albeit by accident, is to change the whole character of Waco. No, the victims, not the perpetrators, would continue to shoulder all the blame. To compound the injustice, the survivors were subjected to a vindictive prosecution. Some of the Davidians were sentenced to 40 years in prison, even though the jury found them innocent of conspiracy to murder. To the horror of the jurors, convictions on minor charges were misconstrued by the judge to vastly increase the penalties. As jury foreman Sarah Bain said later, the federal government was absolutely out of control here. We spoke in the jury room about the fact that the wrong people were on trial, that it should have been the ones who planned the raid and orchestrated it and insisted on carrying out this plan who should have been on trial. Quite so. It was not the first time nor the last time that Bill Clinton would misuse the judicial apparatus to shape political perceptions. He practiced the art as the governor of Arkansas and has continued to use it as an instrument of intimidation in Washington. Sending people to prison on false charges or trying to do so is his specialty. Sending people to prison on false charges or trying to do so is Bill Clinton's specialty, which is the chief reason why I have come to revile the man. Behind the facade of a roguish bon viveur, Clinton conceals a very nasty streak. So he's saying that Saturday Night Live character where he's laughing and looking around for women, that's part of him, but that's more of a facade than anything. Behind that, he has no problem whatsoever with setting people up or hiring those who do, like Janet Reno. And so that's the end of the introduction by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Now we'll talk just a little bit about some of the ATF lies in the first days after the government production, government slash SPLC production that was the OKC bombing. Now here's what Clinton says. Relaxing on Air Force One after the 96 elections, Clinton says of the Oklahoma bombing, "It broke a spell in the country as people began searching for our common ground again," he said. So what he's saying is that it worked. The government and the SPLC, its cat paw, produced an event that scared people who were earlier angry. It intimidated them into leaving the militias. And Clinton quickly put through anti-terror legislation, just as Bush did after 9/11. So this is the way government works. They create the pretext for the legislation they want to get passed. And they're not above killing people. In fact, that's one of their commonest ways of doing it. They kill a bunch of Americans, they blame the groups they hate, they get the laws passed that they want passed. And that's exactly what happened in Oklahoma, and that's exactly what happened on 9/11. Pritchard says, "The searing destruction of the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building on April 19, 1995, so about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, was the most traumatic event in the U.S. since the assassination of Kennedy. Had it been carried out by foreign radicals, the impact would have been less, but it was a homegrown conspiracy, Americans committing mass murder against other Americans. A crash full of infants had been massacred in cold blood by Americans." He says, "President Clinton's analysis cannot be faulted. The bombing had a catalytic effect, abruptly changing the chemistry of American politics. One has to think back to the mood in Washington in April 95 to understand what Clinton meant. Republican Party was completing its 100-day march. The contract with America was being rushed through the House at breakneck speed. The world was kneeling in obeisance before Speaker Newt Gingrich, even as President Clinton spoke plaintively of being, quote, relevant. Think back to the triumphalist language of the Republican diehards. The Education Department was going to be abolished before breakfast, the Commerce Department before lunch, and HUD before supper, and the Environmental Protection Agency was going to be torched in a spectacular bonfire before bedtime. Rhetoric leapt ahead of reality, of course, but the tone and the manner of the new leadership was deeply unsettling to great numbers of Americans of mellow conservative views. Things were getting out of hand. The bombing brought it into sharp focus. The militia movement, right-wing talk radio, the perceived Gingrich onslaught against government, all melded together in the public mind as one rampant movement of extremism. Clinton seized the moment. He castigated talk radio for broadcasting, quote, a relentless clamor of hatred and division." See, government carries out the bombing, and then it blames right-wing talk radio. It blames white males for what government did, and passes laws to prevent their banding together to solve the problem. "The right," he said, "was sowing distrust of government institutions and creating a climate that fostered recourse to violence." He did not name the Republicans as co-conspirators. He did not have to. The media clerisy made the connection for him. They all but said that Tim McVeigh was the military expression of the Gingrich agenda. Republicans had failed to understand that rhetoric has consequences, upon the commentators, and now look what had happened. So, if you criticize government, you're responsible for what happened at Oklahoma City. It's just like white racism is blamed for black failure. Blacks commit crimes and white racism is to blame. The government commits crimes and angry white males on talk radio are to blame. And basically then, you know, the Republicans spotted weakly and got their ass kicked politically by Clinton. "President traveled to Oklahoma and handled the ceremony of grief with consummate skill. He visited the rescue workers. He held the hands of victims. He said all the right things. His empathy was boundless. The polls noted that 4/5 of Americans admired this human touch. Overnight, his job rating went from 42 to 51%, although this did not begin to reflect the tectonic changes beneath the surface of American politics. Clinton had come back to life and the Justice Department was riding high. And you know what? I think we're going to stop right there. We're not even going to go any farther. That's the setup. So what you understand now is the mood before the Oklahoma City and how it changed after the bombing. And tomorrow we'll get into the specifics of the lies. Or next time we do a Radio Astina, we will get into the, probably next Tuesday, say, we will get into the specifics of the lies about that production, which are legion. So, I'm going to call it off there. I have some stuff I've got to do. I think we've covered enough for today. And I encourage you all to join VNNforum.com. We're putting in a lot of time and effort there to make it a good archive as well as a free speech discussion forum. And you can also read what we post at govnn.com, vanguardnewsnetwork.com. I'm going to be doing Radio Astina hopefully once or twice a week. As long as our equipment's functioning and my health keeps up, we'll do it. And all these shows are archived by Gibson, our other fine archivist, quickly after they appear. We encourage you, we want you to circulate these and let people hear the truth for once that they're not getting other places. And with that, I'm going to play two more songs and then I'm going to cut it off. So, thanks for listening to Radio Astina, product of VNNforum.com. I'm Alex Linder and I will talk to you early next week.
I took your daughter down to the water. Drown our feelings for each other down to the water. Took your daughter. Don't give me up cause I love the water. Water gun, have some, it's real fun. I love my water gun.